That means the British ruling Conservative Party enters another leadership race following the resignation of Prime Minister Liz Truss amid turmoil in government economic plans. A U.S. judge sentences Steve Bannon, a senior aide to former President Donald Trump, to 4 months in prison for refusing to testify in a probe into the Capitol attack. Mourners call for justice following the killing of yet another Palestinian teenager during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, Conservative British lawmakers are declaring who they're backing to become the party leader and next prime minister after Liz Truss's resignation left the position up for grabs. So far, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his former finance minister Rishi Sunak are leading the race with the most backing from MPs. Many British politicians doubt that Johnson will receive the 100 nominations he needs from lawmakers to run for the position. They're citing a lack of confidence in Johnson as his recent premiership was blighted with scandals and allegations of misconduct. Penny Mordaunt, who is popular with party members, is the only one to formally declare her candidacy for Tory leadership. So far, Liz Truss quit on Thursday after only 6 weeks in office. There were growing calls for her to resign over a host of issues, including her controversial economic package. Steve Bannon, a top aide to former U.S. President Donald Trump, is sentenced to 4 months in jail for refusing to testify in a probe into last year's Capitol riot. A U.S. district judge allowed him to remain free while he fights his appeal. Bannon was also fined $6,500. The congressional probe into the attack on the Capitol is looking into Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election, despite knowing that he had lost the vote. Trump supporters attacked the Capitol building when Congress was certifying President Joe Biden's victory. The attack left several people dead. Bannon also faces money laundering and conspiracy charges for allegedly deceiving donors into giving money to help build Trump's promised wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. If convicted of those charges, he would be sentenced up to 15 years in prison. Where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of News Review, leaders of the European Union have expressed their increasing concern about economic dependency on China despite lacking a unified stance.
The discussion showed that we are witnessing quite an acceleration of trends and tensions. It was very clear from the Congress that we've seen that President Xi is continuing to reinforcing the very assertive and self-reliant course China has taken.
The EU chief added that Beijing is continuing its mission to establish its dominance in East Asia and its influence globally. She also warned of the close ties between China and Russia amid the war in Ukraine. Von der Leyen noted that the EU has learned its lesson after the chaos caused by its reliance on Russian energy and urged EU leaders to stay vigilant about their reliance on China. Meanwhile, EU leaders are seeking to avoid outright confrontation with Beijing.
We also think that we need to be able to engage with China on global issues. Climate change, health are obvious examples that illustrate that. On these subjects, we want to engage with China. It's therefore a debate that showed a very clear desire not to be naive, but also not to be in a logic of systematic confrontation.
Michel said the EU is seeking a balance in economic relations with China. French President Emmanuel Macron also said that the bloc needs to rethink its trade dialogue with China. Macron called for a more even playing field between the two commercial powerhouses. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said that a government delegation will visit China next month. Leaders made the remarks during talks held in Brussels, where they discussed many other issues, including offering more aid to Ukraine. The EU has struggled to fashion a cohesive stance toward China because of differing economic interests of its members. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Jerome Hughes, who's with us from Brussels. Also, we have Professor at University of San Francisco, Stephen Roddy, who's with us from San Francisco. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Jerome. Walk us through what was discussed in this meeting, specifically focusing on China among European leaders.
That's right. Well, the first day of it, Thursday and Friday, this was a two-day EU leader summit. The first day was all about energy, but certainly today, Friday, on the second day, it was about opening a new front against China. Iran was mentioned quite a lot as well. And, you know, I was speaking, interviewing one commentator, a political commentator who's been observing the EU for many years earlier. And the point was made that, you know, as the EU keeps talking about trying to become more autonomous and independent, it's basically trying to get rid of Russia's energy, trying to cut out China, dependency on China. And what does that mean? It means that it's moving closer and closer to the United States. So that basically, in one sense, it has been criticized in the past for following Washington's lead on everything. But now, actually, that's becoming more clear. And it's intensifying because of this sort of this goal of completely taking away Russia, completely taking away China. And don't forget, the EU was set up as a peace project initially. That was the idea. But now it's just becoming sort of like one big bloc that is just associated with the United States and nowhere else. And, you know, this phrase you talked about, we talked about this, you know, a more assertive China. This is a phrase that we kept hearing for so many years about Russia, a more assertive Russia. And this is a phrase we kept hearing again at this summit, a more assertive China. And also we heard as well that Iran was dragged into it as well, claims of human rights abuses and claims of supplying drones to Russia for combat in Ukraine. But when we know that all the details surrounding those claims are very spurious and vehemently also contested, even at the level of the United Nations. And of course, again, the commentator I was speaking to made the point that, you know, this is, although these claims are very much contested and spurious, the EU goes ahead and on Thursday placed new sanctions on Iran, whereas at the same time we see in other conflict areas where there's clear and unambiguous breaches of fundamental human rights and breaches of international law, for example, in the occupied territories with respect to Palestine, the EU just completely turns a blind eye. So actually, out of all of this, the EU isn't looking very great. It's looking very dependent on the United States. Energy prices are going through the roof because we're importing huge amounts of liquefied natural gas from the US, which is very expensive. Citizens are paying for that. Ordinary citizens are paying for that. Inflation, interest rates going through the roof. And all the while, all we hear is against Russia, against China, against Iran, pro-United States. And actually, it's the ordinary people who are really suffering.
Stephen Roddy, give us your opinion about Europe's concerns with regards to China. The EU says it wants a balance in economic relations with Beijing. The French president, for his part, Emmanuel Macron, said the bloc needs to rethink its trade dialogue with China. Help us better understand the stance the EU has right now with regards to China.
Well, I have to agree with your previous commentator that the rhetoric coming out of Europe is very discouraging from the perspective of those of us in the U.S. who are working hard to change policies here. As you know, Representative Pelosi, who represents my district in Congress and is the Speaker of our House of Representatives, visited Taiwan at the beginning of August, which marked a major turning point, unfortunately, toward even greater tension and even possible military confrontation. We're working very hard here, the peace community in California and the U.S. as a whole, to try to dial back all of the moves that are being made across the U.S. and unfortunately now increasingly with Europe to confront China militarily. And our hope is that Europe will reject the kind of rhetoric and actual policies that are emanating primarily from Washington. But unfortunately, Even in spite of the attempt to tone it down a bit, Europe's rhetoric is just a slightly milder version, I think, of what we're hearing in Washington. So the same things are happening here in terms of the escalation and the economic impacts of both the confrontation with China and the support for the Ukraine in the war with Russia. So what we need now more than anything else is collaboration across all of the different political divides that unfortunately are being exacerbated in large part by the kind of messianic rhetoric in favor of Western values that we're hearing from both Europe and the U.S.
So would you say that in this regard, the EU is basically following the lead of the United States with its tensions regarding China? And also, why isn't there a more cohesive stance among the EU members when it comes to Beijing?
I'm not probably qualified to say what exactly is going on among the individual members and between the individual members of the EU. But certainly there is greater interest, I think, in certain countries in improving ties with China, or at least in maintaining the kind of cooperation that has been developing through the Belt and Road Initiative and through other economic developments of the last decade or so. So yes, I'm sure there's a certain amount of disagreement, which probably is because we're dealing with independent states, even if they are part of the union, perhaps a bit more difficult to reconcile with the more bellicose rhetoric that is coming out of certain capitals in Europe. I don't know to what extent they're collaborating and cooperating, that is the U.S. and the EU. It seems to me that much of this is happening through NATO, since NATO is now apparently developing a Pacific wing that, or a kind of arm that is extending far beyond the Atlantic region, the North Atlantic region. And unfortunately, that's having a terrible effect in the Pacific, in the Pacific states, the Oceania, and all across the so-called Asia Pacific, as all sorts of military arrangements and new, or at least re-strengthened military ties are developing across all, to greater or lesser extents, aimed at China. So from the perspective of the people that I'm working with here, we would like to see Europe really develop an independent line and to see the world not so much through the lens of quote-unquote European values, Western values. That's a very Eurocentric and very ethnocentric position to take. And I think Europe can benefit by taking a much broader view and looking at the whole situation across the world and particularly across Eurasia in a new light.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Jerome Hughes, our correspondent, joining us from Brussels, and thanks to Professor Stephen Roddy, joining us from San Francisco. With that, brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review, but do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come. A funeral has been held for the 19-year-old Palestinian who lost his life during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Mourners condemned Israeli crimes and called for justice. Salah Bariki died after being shot in the neck as Israeli forces stormed Jenin in the early hours of Friday. Three other Palestinians were also wounded during the raid. In reaction, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas stressed that the raids won't undermine Palestinians' determination to liberate all of Palestine. Hamas also pledged that it won't let the Palestinians' blood to be spilled in vain. For months, the Israeli military has been conducting a brutal campaign to quash growing resistance in Jenin, killing dozens of Palestinians during its raids. The latest victim brings to 124 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank this year. Iran's foreign ministry says sanctions on Iranian media make Western mantras of freedom of expression and the right to access information ring hollow. Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani made the comments in reaction to Canadian sanctions on Iranian outlets, including Press TV. He says The sanctions are a violation of the Iranian nation's fundamental right to make its voice and opinion heard across the world. Kanani said Canada and its Western allies believe that Iranians have no right to express their opinion while enduring economic sanctions. He pointed out that Canada has a history of apartheid behavior, as evidenced by the discovery of mass graves of indigenous children there. And now Kanani stressed Canada has turned to media apartheid. Political commentator Arnold August believes Canada follows U.S. policies when it comes to Iran and many other countries.
The Canadian government, over the last few years, with regards to many countries, but specifically with regards to Iran, they simply use the U.S. State Department and White House talking points against Iran. So that is the pretext, that is so-called repression of women in Iran. Interesting, coming from a country, Canada, a colonial settler state that is now famous throughout the world for having committed and still commits genocide against the native peoples in our country, they are in a position, a moral position, to judge Iran with regards to the question of human rights. I mean, it is basically a regime change effort pushed forward by the United States and Canada, unfortunately, as a very close and faithful ally of the United States, is following through on it by adding these sanctions.
Tehran says the claims of Western countries to support Iranian women are not sincere and in good faith, stressing that Iranian women do not need guardians.
Iranian women are smart, well-educated, dedicated, and patriotic, and are aware of their rights. They also understand how to engage with the government in a peaceful and constructive manner in order to advance their rights. Therefore, we advise those Western states that they are not required to act as guardians or caretakers of Iranian women or speak on their behalf.
Zahra Ershedi was speaking at a UN Security Council meeting on women, peace and security. She criticized some Western countries for what she called baseless allegations against the Islamic Republic under the pretext of supporting Iranian women. Ershedi denounced those allegations as attempts to politicize women's rights, adding that such claims are in line with double standard approaches toward human rights. She noted that inhumane anti-Iran sanctions by the U.S. have violated the basic rights of Iranian women. Ershedi talked about the significant role of women in Iran's various domains. She said more than half of the population of Iranian university students are comprised of females. Ershedi said 73% of Iran's medical specialists are now made up of women.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Despite the new government taking office in the United Kingdom, the economic conditions in this country have not improved, but have also worsened. Most people in this country are struggling with huge increases in energy prices and the cost of living. The very dire economic conditions have forced people to do things they don't want to do. They have been forced to reduce or even forgo their daily meals, and in order to feed their children, they should get help from food banks. Also, figures showed reports of energy theft have increased as Britons face rising electricity and gas bills. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has more. Economists warn Britain's economy is expected to shrink around 0.2% each quarter from October through to June of next year. The EY Item Club predicted in its autumn forecast this prolonged economic decline will result in a 0.3% fall in gross domestic product or GDP for 2023 as a whole. The Economic Forecasting Group has significantly downgraded its previous summer forecast, which estimated the economy would grow by 1% in 2023. A combination of high energy prices, surging inflation, rising interest rates, and global economic weakness have driven up the likelihood that the British economy will face a recession until the middle of next year. As an economy enters a technical recession, given its GDP falls for two or more consecutive quarters. The government intervened in early September to put a ceiling on energy bills at £2,500 a year for the typical household, and has since pledged to cover a proportion of rocketing electricity costs for businesses as well. The move is supposedly set to ease the pressure on household incomes and prevent the collapse of businesses that would otherwise be unable to afford the mounting bills. Furthermore, EY said, once high inflation eases, the weaker pound boosts exports and the Bank of England's interest rate hikes end. Gross domestic product or GDP should return to growth in the second half of 2023. The economy is then expected to expand 2.4% in 2024 and 2.3% in 2025. But the group warned that there is a risk that growth could be dragged down by further economic shocks. Figures showed reports of energy theft have soared as Britons face rising bills for electricity and gas. With a cost of living crisis mounting, the number of reports made to the Crime Stoppers charity has almost trebled since 2017-2018, with a rise of more than 20% in just the past 6 months. The chair of an influential select committee of MPs warned the increase shows the desperation of households hit by rocketing electricity and gas prices. Electricity theft, which pushes up bills for customers, carries a maximum prison sentence of 5 years, while gas theft is also illegal. Crime Stoppers figures show 8,289 reports of energy theft in the United Kingdom in the year to the end of July, a rise from 2,876 reports in the 12 months ending July of 2018. In the 6 months to the end of July, there were 4,559 energy theft reports to Crime Stoppers in the United Kingdom, up from 3,730 in the 6 months before that, representing a 22% increase when comparing the two periods. Crime Stoppers is contracted by the non-profit Retail Energy Code Company to run the energy theft tip-off service, allowing people to anonymously make reports. The Retail Energy Code Company, or RECO's website explains, Crime Stoppers securely notify the tip-off to the relevant gas or electricity supplier for investigation. Additionally, energy fraud reports to trade body UK Revenue Protection Association increased by 54% in just 6 months, from 717 cases in six-month period from July to December of 2021 up to 1,104 cases from January to June of this year. While police forces in England and Wales received nearly 3,600 reports of dishonest use of electricity in the year to March, up 13% year on year. The British newspaper The Guardian covers the same story from a different angle. New data showed millions of British people were forced to skip meals or go a whole day without eating in recent months. The Food Foundation charity said as the UK's cost of living crisis deepened, nearly one in five low-income families experienced food insecurity in September, meaning more people went hungry than during the chaotic first weeks of the COVID lockdown. According to the Foundation's latest tracker, hunger levels have more than doubled since January, with nearly 10 million adults and 4 million children unable to eat regular meals last month, prompting calls for stronger measures to protect vulnerable households. These included demands for free school meals to be made available to an extra 800,000 children amid reports of hungry school kids stealing food from classmates, skipping lunch because they could not afford school meals, or bringing in packed lunches containing just a single slice of bread. Campaigners also condemned the government's refusal to rule out real-term cuts to benefits, which it is estimated would leave already struggling families hundreds of pounds a year worse off. The Foundation's tracker found more than half of Universal Credit claimants were struggling to get the food they needed. The leading public health expert, Sir Michael Marmot, called the rise in hunger alarming and said it would have damaging health consequences for societies worst off, including increased occurrences of stress, mental illness, obesity, diabetes and heart disease. A separate survey of primary schools by chefs in schools found half were providing a free meal for children in poverty who were ineligible for free school meals. Over two-thirds were referring parents to food banks, and just under 50% were offering food parcels for families themselves. The charity's chief executive, Naomi Duncan, said, "This research reveals the shocking reality that teachers see on a daily basis." Naomi Duncan added, "The situation is appalling and getting so much worse. We call on the government to urgently extend eligibility for free school meals to all families receiving universal credit so that support reaches the kids who need it most." The growth in food insecurity has accompanied the shrinking spending power of low-income families because by static wages and benefit cuts in recent years. Faced with heat or eat choices, they have often opted to rein in food spending, although the recent squeeze has left some households too poor to afford either. Food insecurity is a relatively new formal metric designed to gauge the numbers of people who struggle to get the food they need because of lack of money or access. It has been formally adopted by the UK Food Standards Agency, which warned in June that increasing poverty meant food insecurity was escalating rapidly. Since January, rising food and energy bills coupled with the removal of COVID support has precipitated a sharp rise in hunger in Britain. More than two-thirds of food insecure families said they cooked less or turned off fridges to cut energy costs.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
There's nothing more beautiful for me than to see a young kid, 10, 12, 13, 15, that's proud to be a Muslim. That stops and says, no, my name is Muhammad, not Muhammad. It's Ali, not Ali. You can do it. Say it with me. Oh, I tried very hard to get Asad. I got Assad, I'll take that. But Assad, I couldn't take. No, say it properly. That's all part of the pride factor. Because the flip side is that if you don't identify with the deen, then any remnant of the deen inside of you, from the physical hijab, to the beard, to the name on your business card, all will not resemble Islam. We run from that as far as possible. This is a crisis we're facing right now. And so naturally now, right, if you don't feel like you belong to the deen, you're not going to follow its tenets, you're not going to worship that God, you're just going to you go through the motions until one day and someday when you become an adult and you say, you know what, I'm denouncing my religion. I get too many phone calls that my kid told me I'm agnostic, I'm an atheist now, Malana. Apne Shia log, in this GTA, can you come and talk to them? And I go to their house, I talk to them, and I tell them, please, you know, tell me about your atheism, it sounds intriguing. Convert me to be an atheist. And there's nothing there. It's hollow. They just don't want to be Muslim. So the next best option is a freedom-seeking atheist. No worship, no accountability, no God. Sounds pretty good to them. It's a crisis. And we have to now dissect this across 10 nights. Lots to talk about. Oh my God, lots to talk about. But let's start off with history. I've learned to realize the hard way that history is very important in everything and every topic in the deen. There are people out there that are master historians. I was never like that. In class, in the Hausa, it was that tariq class that I would run from. I found it dry, I found it boring, but I realized over some time that history has a funny way of repeating itself. If we learn of those previous to us, we can avoid a lot of mistakes right now. Let's examine a little bit of the mission of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. Allahumma salli ala. When the Holy Prophet attempted now to implement Islam in Mecca, the misconception was that he was looking to convert the entire region. Okay. The misconception still is, because I've had these talks with a lot of these youth, that there is this compulsion in religion. That they take on this Taliban, Daesh, ISIS mentality, either you're with us or we will behead you. And they take this ugly brush and they paint it with the entire deen of Islam today. And it becomes a very black and white, on and off, one and zero binary deen. That's not what the Prophet was all about. The Prophet was a part of this pre-Islamic Arabian peninsula, Arabian civilization, Arabian environment. And he did three things that are very crucial for us to understand. Now let me say one thing here while I'm here. I'm bound to upset my elders in this ashra. And I don't want to do that. I love all of you. But the reality is that identity is a compound discussion. Meaning what? There's multiple factors that help us identify who we are. Part of it is where we live. So the term Canadian Muslim that drives some of our elders a little bit mad, it's not a blasphemous term. Now you can, to make yourself feel better, no, bolo Muslim Canadian, fine, no problem. You can put Islam first, no problem. Where you put the dash is up to you. Where I'm headed in terms of this historical discussion, because by the way, the Quran also invites us to study those before us. فَصِيرٌ فِي الْأَرْضِ فَانْظُرُ كَيْفَ كَانَ عَقِبَةُ الْمُكَذِّبِينَ. Travel the earth. Do sayr of the land, as you say in Urdu. Do sayr, travel the land. فَانْظُرُ, look, meaning ponder. What is the aqibat? What is the ultimate destiny of those who have denied Allah? Study their lives. Where did they go wrong? What happened? Where was the misguidance? How could it be? If you study Fir'aun himself, it is an intriguing study. This was a man who didn't deny God. He did not deny God. He believed in a higher power for sure. But he believed in a God of other gods. He believed in God to be the Sarparast, the God of the heavens. But this everyday Zamini God is people like me. I'm the God of Egypt. That God doesn't have time to come down and do these small little, you know, minute things. I'm in charge of you guys now. But absolutely. And you see that all throughout the story of Nabi Musa leading up to his drowning. There were moments of softness Fir'aun had. But he had horrible advisors that would whisper in his ear and bring him back to his corrupt ways. Letter number 31 in Nahj al-Balagha. Beautiful letter written by Imam Ali to his son Imam Mujtaba. Beautiful. Paragraphs and paragraphs of nothing but treasures. Advice that you and I could really change our life on today. In that very same letter now he says, study the lives of those before you. And he gives his own example. I studied civilizations before me to the point where it felt like I walked with them through their ruins. I was there in their successes. I grieved in their deficiencies. Why? It's important to pick up signs before the actual misguidance happens. So it's important that we understand this history. Now, very, very briefly, the Prophet came and had adopted three principles. Because not everything in the Jahiliyyah era he threw out the window. No. Didn't reject everything. There were certain principles and certain cultural norms inside of Arabia that either he accepted and used for the betterment of Islam, number one. Number two, he either redirected towards God, or number three, outright rejected. I'll give you examples. The outright rejection, of course, were things like burying daughters alive. There was no compromise there. You can't use that for any betterment or any goodness. No. He replaces that now with this Surah An-Nisa that elevates women inside of Islam. Easy example. Where he would redirect the focus was on this tribalism, this loyalty towards your tribe. During that pre-Islamic era, you lived and died by your tribe. You were known by your tribe. This loyalty towards your tribe was unbelievable. If one person of that tribe was disrespected or killed, the entire tribe would go and avenge that. You were known not by your name, not even by your father's name sometimes. Which tribe do you belong to? And they would apply a certain stigma to you based on that of the tribe. That's incredible. The Prophet says, take that loyalty now instead of the tribe now and come to the tribe of God. The exact same loyalty redirected towards God. And the final one that he actually used for the benefit, one example is, the Arabs back then, even today, have an immensely strong memory. Their hafizah was very qawi and very strong back then. And he used that for the Qur'an. A wahi would come down, the Prophet would summon two different groups of 10 people each. Those who would do hifz of the verse, those who would write down the verse. You teach the verse to the 10 hafidhin, say, look, memorize it, repeat it back to me, make sure your arab is right, go back and teach others. He would also explain the ta'wil and tafsir of every verse, go back and use that memory of yours to store that verse in your mind. On the flip side, he'd say, make sure you write down the verse properly. Why is that important? Because after his death, when there's a whole discussion in ulum al-Quran that I don't want to get into, about the compilation of the Quran, there is a massive difference of opinion. Some say the Quran was compiled already. Others say no. Imam Ali, 6 months after the death of the Prophet, sat in his home and compiled it in the order of the nuzul of the Quran. This whole idea that Shias have their own Quran comes from this concept. I don't want to go down that route. I'll really go on a tangent. I don't want to do that. enough to know that when there were individuals who wanted to do a little bit of tahrif, a little bit of distortion of the Quran, add some surahs, take some out, it was these individuals who did hifz of the Quran that would come and say, look, I was mawjood there when this wahi came down. This was not a surah of the Quran, this was a hadith by the Holy Prophet. This was not a hadith, this was a surah. For example, Surah Falak and Surah An-Nas, one group had said these are nothing but du'as against black magic. They're not surahs of the Quran. It was these Arabs who used their memory to say, no, absolutely this is a standalone surah. So the pride by which we say that our Quran was never, ever distorted, not one fi, not one an was removed or added, part of it comes from the idea that the Prophet used this memory of theirs for the betterment of Islam. My point is, this wasn't an arrival of Islam, let's wipe the slate clean, everyone who believes in everything, that's wrong, this is wrong, let's start fresh. No. He did his best to integrate into an existing community and present an option and present another avenue, another sabir, another path of which you can attain success in.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The fabricated regime of Israel is so atrocious that it must be removed from the face of planet Earth so that not only Palestinians, but also all the oppressed people around the world will have the chance to live in peace. On the Zionist regime's recent crimes against Palestinians, we have looked at some of the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. The website of Crescent International wrote, "The illegitimate Zionist regime has escalated its war on defenseless Palestinians in the West Bank and East Al-Quds. Within a span of 3 days, 5 Palestinians, all of them minors, were shot and killed by the Zionists. Another Palestinian, Osama Adawi, 18, was shot dead recently by Israeli regime troops in Al-Arab camp in Al-Khalil." The Palestinian Health Ministry said,
bringing the number of Palestinian youth killed to 6. Meanwhile, the Nablus-based Lion's Den resistance group called for days of rage against Israeli occupation in a statement and urged citizens to join in strikes and protests near Israeli regime checkpoints. The localities targeted are the sprawling Palestinian refugee camp at Jenin, the northern city of Nablus and Ramallah. On October 8 morning, heavily armed Israeli regime troops using armored vehicles, bulldozers, military helicopters and combat drones attacked Jenin. The invading forces shot dead 2 Palestinian teenagers there. The Palestinian Health Ministry named the youths shot and killed as Mahmoud Assos, 18, and Ahmad Daragma, 16. Assos was shot in the neck and Daragma was hit in the head. At least 11 more Palestinians were wounded, 3 of whom remain in critical condition. These murders and injuries occurred after 2 more minors, including a 14-year-old boy, were killed near Galilea and Ramallah the night before. Adel Ibrahim Dawood, 14, was shot in the head near the Zionist regime's separation barrier in Galilea. Mahdi Ladawe, 17, another victim of Israeli regime criminality, was shot in the chest near Ramallah. Meanwhile, a Palestinian child, 12-year-old Mahmoud Muhammad Samoudi, was hit in the stomach by an Israeli bullet during the September 28 army attack on Jenin and died on October 10th. The Zionist regime's killing of Palestinians has gone on amid the siege of Shafat refugee camp in Zionist-occupied East Al-Quds. Residents of the refugee camp, that number more than 120,000, have been besieged in their locality for 4 days. Palestinians needing critical medical treatment, dialysis or cancer treatment, are unable to go to hospital. Basic supplies, such as food and water, are also running low due to the tight Israeli regime blockade. Why has the Zionist regime blockaded Shafat? The occupation army alleges that a man who approached the checkpoint leading to the camp opened fire. The Zionist regime police identified the suspect as a 22-year-old resident of Shafat. He is still at large, but his mother, father, and brother have all been detained, according to Zionist media reports. Places like Jenin, Nablus, and Ramallah are special targets for the Zionist regime occupation forces. Both Jenin and Nablus have become hubs of resistance activity, although the price for Palestinians is quite steep. More than 160 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli regime fire this year, including 50 in the Gaza Strip. The remainder, 110 Palestinians, have been killed in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds. The death toll rate in the West Bank is the highest recorded in a single year since 2014. Heavily armed Zionist squatters, as known as Israeli settlers, now routinely storm Masjid al-Aqsa as well as destroy Palestinian olive trees and harvests. The Zionist occupiers also continue to force Palestinians off their land in Masafer Yatta. Of the 750 Palestinian political prisoners held under Israeli regime's illegal administrative detention policy, some than 30 are on hunger strike to protest their mistreatment. They are demanding their release. Only the Zionist occupiers are able to get away with such crimes. It is an outlaw regime that must be removed from Palestine if its people are to have a chance to live in peace. Al Jazeera English wrote in its website, Israeli regime forces have shot dead a Palestinian in a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank, the Palestinian Health Ministry has said. Osama Adawi, 18, was killed by occupation Israeli military live fire to the stomach in Al-Arub camp. In southern West Bank, the Health Ministry said. Official Palestinian news agency Wafa said he was killed in confrontations during which Israeli regime forces shot at Palestinians and used tear gas. Another person was injured in the Al-Arub camp and was in moderate condition in hospital, Wafa reported. The Israeli regime military said the troops pursued people who were throwing rock stones vehicles on a road near the camp.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. O my brother believer, live up to your name. O my brother, if someone calls you a believer, you are happy. But if someone raises the slightest doubt about your faith, you're upset. You might tell me, what's the point in telling us we don't really have faith and we don't really believe in your speeches? Oh, my so-called believing brother, do you do infaq? Remember, this isn't just about whether you spend money. You spend a lot of money. You spend so much money during the month of Ramadan. You cook delicious food. You lay out an impressive spread. You invite your friends and family. You spend a lot. But do you also do infaq? Dear speaker, how much you speak, how much you breathe, how much you use your lungs, your chest, your existence, your body and your limbs. How much you deploy your powers of explanation. But do you do infaq from this power? It is not artful to speak a lot. Rather, saying that which needs to be said, that is artful. The first is not infaq, only the second is. O you who spends his high dignity and prestige, you write a letter to someone. You have a meeting with someone to achieve something. You see someone to make sure they do what you wanted. Someone tells someone else to do something. Someone worthy of respect uses someone to get somewhere. You spend your dignity and prestige, but do you do infaq with it?
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
O you who spends his wealth in various ways, whether in the name of religion or the name of something else. Yes, sometimes a person spends his money in the name of religion without that being infaq. Do not be surprised about this, as it does happen. And how bitter it is when it does. You give so much money in the name of religion, you spend so much. But this still isn't infaq because you aren't filling a gap, because you're not curing an ailment, because you're not meeting a need that is present in society. No, the real capital of the believer, the thing that is the mark of a true believer, is nothing other than infaq. And spend, yunfiquna, out of what we have provided them. So if you really want to give your time, or your dignity, or your money, or something, you had better think long and hard. Is this really infaq, or are you just spending haphazardly? It is they who are the truly faithful. They shall have ranks near their Lord, forgiveness. The Quran, Surah 8, verse 4. This is the same forgiveness, maghfirah, whose meaning we explained in yesterday's lecture, and I hope that you can recall what we discussed.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. Guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.